It's perfectly legal. You will have no temptation to run for president, which is illegal. It's the one thing you can't have. And apparently, we love regional accents. I think it would be a wonderful thing to have you, not only as a guest of the CNU, but as an advisor to this country. And it would be a wonderful thing. Now, my job. What I'm expected to do tonight, and I'm very, very happy to do this, is to memorialize two friends we have lost, two urbanists, two great fellows who passed away this year, and to honor one of our great predecessors. And this year, we lost Rich McLaughlin, and we lost George Seddon. And many of us knew them, and I have just a few words to say about them, and then I'll go on to introduce Bob Stern, the recipient of the Athena Award this year, the Athena Medal. I think many of you, most of you, will recognize Rich. He was a great new urbanist, dedicated his life to it, one of the earliest of the practitioners, one of the most energetic, one of the best networkers. He, after being educated at the University of Minnesota, he went to, Minnesota or Michigan. I've never been up there. Let me check that. Sorry about this. Yes, indeed, Minnesota. University of Minnesota, and he apprenticed with us at DPZ. But principally, he learned to be a new urbanist in that great incubator, the treasure incubator of people, practitioners, and also of great plans, the Treasure Coast Regional Planning Council in Florida, which is well represented here today, and this was in the days of Dan Cara. He, after 5 years there, went back to Minnesota and to Minneapolis, St. Paul, actually, and became one of the advocates, one of the regional advocates that really made the difference. And he was there doing everything. There's a very long list of projects of every kind that he participated in. And I know that he catalyzed several very substantial, very important meetings. So he was one of these indefatigable new urbanists that did everything that was necessary to move it forward. And that is one of the more advanced places in terms of urbanism, regional boundary, and so forth. And Rich was at the center of it. He passed away, apparently still optimistic after a long illness, the last day of last year. And you can see him here, but you may remember him most for his smile. He was always smiling, he was always positive. He was really a great guy. At the end, he had developed among the many things, he was a very good technician. You know, like he was a charming fellow. An energetic one. He was a very good technician. Some of the earliest and best form-based codes were written by him. And what he was doing at the end, he had developed a system of models, beautifully crafted models, that corresponded to all the building types that we tend to use. And he had registered the pattern. We had already used these models in several charrettes. And what was extraordinary about them is that instead of putting merely little blocks, the way some of us tend to do, you know, give the people little blocks, he had actually was very, very precise about the typologies, the densities, and so forth. You could really see what these places would look like. And they were so accurate that you could take a photograph and very quickly render over them. And it wasn't just repetitive in the cookie cutter pseudo houses. Very sophisticated stuff. A wonderful man, and we are very sorry to lose him. He was 50, whatever. And here, another indefatigable new urbanist, Deborah Hempel. Many of you know, who organizes the 101, and who has worked for many firms, has insisted, not only offered, but insists on collecting donations for scholarships. And if you don't remember this, you can Google Deborah Hempel. Just remember the spelling if you would like to donate towards a scholarship. The other wonderful fellow was George Seddon, and he passed away at 80. just 2 weeks ago. And some of us knew him. Every Australian knew him. A South American urbanist knew him. I had a chance to meet him a couple of times and to read several of his books, thanks to Mike Day. And George Seddon was truly an amazing, you can see how elegant he was, what an amazing man he was. He passed away in his garden. He was gardening at 82 weeks ago, and he was found lying in his garden. In 1972, he studied in Australia. He also studied in the United States, again, in the University of Minnesota. You know, two of the great ones went there. Must have been, it probably is a very good place. George wrote nine books and 217 published articles. One of the most important books, perhaps the most important books in influencing New Urbanism in Australia, is one that he published in 1972 called A Sense of Place. And I was given that book when I first worked in Perth. This is Western Australia, when I first worked in Perth. And I was so taken by it for two reasons. First of all, the writing was absolutely beautiful. The book did look like a 1972 book, but that's bad anyway, you know, the 72 graphics. But what was remarkable about it is that it was the first environmental book that spoke about nature and then went right on and spoke about human settlement. And this is something that we've learned, we the New Urbanists. We have the transects, we know that. But we can't forget that until very recently, and even in the minds of many people today, man, humans, humanity is outside of nature. And George Seddon understood from the beginning that humans are within nature. And that is the only way that any headway is to be made in the problems that we have, the environmental problems that we have, if we understand that humans are part of nature. And not in a romantic way, but actually in a technical way. You know, if we do not make cities that people love, even if they have very little green, nature cannot be preserved. And so the human habitat, the creation of the human habitat, in all of its urban glory, is part of the preservation of the natural parts of the country. Now, I had a chance to meet him when he did the project in Western Australia. He was in his house, and we bonded immediately, not only because I had read his book, but because he lived in a hillside, in a kind of Italian, in an Australian version of a peasant house. And it was a garden that was built on a hillside, and it was all native species. Four of his books were written on landscape. And by the way, I should add that he was a professor four times on different, he had chairs in four different subjects: English, geology, philosophy, and environmental science. Four of them in different places, one of them at the University of Oregon. And he used that knowledge and integrated it beautifully in his books. His books were as beautifully written as someone who knows English really well could do, and he folded in everything that was were the fields of his knowledge. But what we bonded is that in this hillside in Perth, I must imagine a kind of peasant house on a hillside and native species. I realized it was an extraordinary garden design, and I said, "You know the Villa Gambaraya, don't you? This is a relatively obscure Italian garden." And he looked at me and said, "Yes, you got it, didn't you?" And that was the beginning of the friendship. It was a wonderful. So he was very provincial in the sense that he was attached to his province, but he was exceedingly sophisticated. He would go to Italy all the time. Incidentally, he was also stopped by Philadelphia. And he told me this, and he was a modest man. Well, he was sort of semi-modest. He wasn't completely sort of ludicrous or cloyingly modest. And he told me that Ian McCarr, the great environmentalist, had actually selected him as his successor at the University of Pennsylvania. And you know, at the time, he was the most illustrious environmentalist, one of the most illustrious planners. It was the great position to be designated by Ian McCarr. But he went back to Perth. It was his place. And he spent his entire life there making it happen. And you, those of you who get around, know that there's a disproportionate number of Australian urbanists, not only in Australia, but actually here in this Congress. Now, Chip Covenant and Wendy Morris had a lot to do with it, and Mike Day, another indefatigable person, has a lot to do with it. but they were all, but the soil was fertilized by George Seven. That first book that he wrote sensitized them all. And I'm very sorry to lose him, and it actually reminds me when we were in that charrette that I actually had several times the choice of hanging out with him or working, and I made the wrong choice and worked. And I'm sorry that I did so, because it was a pleasure and it was a great learning experience to be with George Seven. The third person that I have the chance to speak of today is Robert Stern. And he is very much better known to us, and he's the recipient of the Athena Medal. Just a little bit of the Athena Medal. The medals themselves are each different. They're actually made differently. Athena sometimes has this look, sometimes it's slightly different. And the Athena Medal is, the roughness of it is very similar to the Hellenistic coins that you find. This is, in fact, a Hellenistic coin. There is Athena on the right, and you should know that she is the defender of the city. She's a warrior goddess and the defender of the city. And she's also the goddess of wisdom. And that is the owl, the representative owl on the left. Someone added to me the other day that the austerity of Athena was an interesting point. The austerity and warrior-like qualities of Athena. We should never, as New Urbanists, get soft. It's one of the nice things about Gardner Frank. He's not soft. He's a warrior also, and so is the Prime Minister. And if you're not that way, I don't think you can be a true New Urbanist. But she was a warrior goddess. And another thing about the owl is that the owl flies at night at the end of the day. And part of the analogy is that wisdom comes towards the end of life, towards the end of life when you're older. That is generally the case with me, for example. The older I get, the wiser I get. That was certainly not the case with Robert Stern, who was monstrously smart at age 22. And now I begin his biography, what I know of him. Bob Stern is one of the very best architects in this country and in the world. Bob Stern is one of the very best writers on architecture in this country and in the world. And Bob Stern is one of the very best professors. And in each of these fields, he has applied himself with such energy and productivity that if that is the only thing he did, it would be remarkable. If all he did was architecture, it would be absolutely remarkable. If you saw the number of books, physically, when piled up, that he has written, it would be remarkable. And if you could see the energy with which he appears at Yale, to every lecture, to virtually every jury, and seems to be there every day, a person that responds to emails within minutes of receiving them, you realize that he's a remarkable person three times over. I think you should, it's inevitable that you would know some of his later books. You know, the five-volume set, now 18 inches long, or high, if you pile them up, on the history of New York, from 1880 to, in fact, yesterday. Great histories, thick with knowledge, perfectly legible, perfectly readable. There are also books on him. There's an almost equal type of books on his work. The many buildings that he and his office have designed and built. Now, the extraordinary thing about these books, you know, this much material, is that many of the buildings, beautifully detailed, beautifully executed buildings, only get a page or two. So when you see a book an inch and a half, it isn't the 20 page per building kind of book. It is, he is running through the stuff. Now, I apprenticed in his office one summer for 6 weeks. And what stunned me, at that time, not only did I work on a single thing for 6 weeks, by the way, I don't know whether Bob knows this, he takes credit for having taught me a lot. What I actually did in that office that summer was make one model of one fireplace.
No.
For 6 weeks. It was incredibly well detailed. And it would come in, and it had to do, I remember this, it had to do with resolving in an existing New York apartment a very odd situation in which a door prevented the watching of both a television and a fireplace. and it couldn't be resolved properly.
Yeah.
And we worked and we worked. His office was seven people at a time. We worked and we worked. And we tried and we did. And then he came in and he solved it very quickly. And he said, "You've got to get up very early in the morning to outperform Bob's turn." Now, at the time, also, there was not so much work in the office that we couldn't visit the buildings. And there's something that we must remember, because Bob Stern is very much a member of the establishment now. But there was a time when I was working there when Bob Stern was the most radical architect in the United States. There was a time when he did the Lang House, when the Lang House, you know, one of the radical postmodernist houses, appeared in the cover of, I believe, Progressive Architecture, that it actually caused a scandal. Everyone in the world knew of that house and knew of Bob Stern. Everyone in the world. And it was a beautiful design. And I think actually those early postmodernist buildings should be looked at again, because they're extraordinary. Of course, postmodernism degenerated into what became the builder's vernacular today, sadly. But postmodernism at one time had an incredible vigor, and it actually demanded the best of designers, and it demanded an extraordinary amount of knowledge. You know, not just the fiction or the fantasy that I invented it this morning, where the knowledge doesn't matter. You have to know a lot to do it. You also have to be an extraordinary designer. The standards were very high. And Bob Stern at the time, who designed everything, including the location of the television sets, was a very, very good designer. And he still is today. And it permeates an office of 250 people. 250, you know, how hard it is to manage. I mean, I'm seeing you here today. I know some of you have a hard time managing breakfast. Some of you have a hard time managing five employees. He manages 250. He manages an architecture school. He manages essentially a publication empire. And he knows every word that comes out and knows his students and knows the buildings very well, and he maintains quality. And I think one of the great things about Bob Stern, and by the way, before I finish, everything he does is open-minded. He really is the best of what postmodernism achieved for a very short period. Yale is the one truly open-minded architecture school in the United States. There are classical schools, there are modernist schools, there are reasonably modernist schools, there are vanguard schools, there are folk schools, there are all sorts of schools. But the only place where the range of Leo Krier and Peter Eisenman can be seen habitually in the same jury. Mm-hmm. And when Frank Gehry and Dimitri Porfirios teach across the hall from each other, that's Yale. And that was his doing. And he went from a school, I remember, not before Bob Stern, he's been a dean 10 years. That was a school in which we could not get our University of Miami students to even apply. Not even to apply. Only one of them, in 10 years, before Bob Stern, only one of them went. Eric Koch did very well, wonderful architect, but only one. No one would go. And he turned it in the teeth of the kind of closed-mindedness that goes for architectural education these days. This Stalinist cutting off of discourse that takes place, he has turned it into the best architecture school and based not only on quality, but on open-mindedness. So it's not just about quality, it is not just about open-mindedness, it is also about quantity. All of these elements are what confront us. Bob Stern.